Okay, I'll take questions. I know y'all agreed with everything I said. So,
I know someone who I think...
Well, it is very interesting. So the point is that there's this account that Robert Rubin, after he left the Clinton administration, I think it was 98, maybe 99, I think 98, and he went to work for Citibank, Citigroup. And apparently he spoke to a group of people in 2000 where he was saying, look, the stock... In his company. They said, look, the stock market's hugely overvalued and, you know, it's going to...
Time to get out.
And, of course, that turned out to be true. And, you know, the question is, why didn't he say that to the nation? Was he, you know, is he working for the insiders rather than the nation as a whole? It's been interesting. It's an interesting question. I don't know Robert Rubin. I think I met him once. I'm actually going to give a paper tomorrow in New York. Tomorrow there's a Clinton conference held by Hofstra University, and I'm on a panel on Rubinomics, and one of the discussants is Gene Sperling, who was in the Clinton administration, who was the head of the National Economic Council, the last one in the Clinton administration. I have no idea. Rubin's going to be at the conference. I don't expect they'll be at my panel. Maybe he will be. Who knows? But in any case, you know, what they were thinking, why they were doing that, it's a very good question. You know, there is sort of an obvious political story, you could say, that, you know, through that period, through 96, 97, 98, 99, things looked great, you know. And, you know, I was talking last week, there are a lot of very good things you could say about that. We got the unemployment rate down to 4%. There was wage growth up and down the income ladder. There were a lot of very good things about the economy during that period. Obviously, from a political standpoint, that made Clinton, you know, popular. You know, you don't want to be the bearer of bad news. You know, while you're sitting there, things are fine. Hope that everything collapses after you leave. That's sort of a simple political story, which, you know, makes a certain amount of sense. Is there something deeper than that? Is it that, you know, there's people on the inside who, you know, they could figure it out, you know, they could share the information? I don't know. You know, I really don't know. You know, I don't know what Rubin knew. You know, if you read his book, it's very funny, because he says very, very little about the stock market, the stock bubble. You know, he says markets go up, markets go down. I mean, there's a line in there. There's like no sort of discussion, you know, this huge event. You know, here's, you know, certainly in retrospect, I mean, I don't think it was terribly debatable at the time, but in retrospect, there was a huge bubble. What did you do about it? So here he's writing the book after it's collapsed. You know, markets go up, markets go down. So, you know, I really don't know what he knew, what he thought. You know, as I say, I think the political story is very simple and straightforward. Is there something more sinister there? You know, I have no idea.
I have a question on the realtors fundamental.
Yeah, that's a good question. So the question is that you had a change in the capital gains tax so that the exemption was previously
$250,000?
Yeah, but there was some... Okay, I'll try to simplify this. They had changed the rules on capital gains from houses, how they were taxed. So prior to 2002, prior to wherever this date was, somewhere during this run-up in housing crisis, and I can't remember the exact date, they changed the rules on capital gains from houses. Previously, you had, under fairly general rules, there are some restrictions on this, you're able to roll over a capital gain. So I buy a place for $100,000, it goes up to $250,000, and I sell it, I have $150,000 capital gain, do I have to pay tax on that? Well, the law previously had been, no, if I buy a $250,000 home, that's fine, no capital gains tax. On the other hand, if I buy a $100,000 home, well, they have to pay tax on that. They then changed that so that I could have a large capital gain, and there is still a cap on it. I don't know.
$250,000.
Okay, $250,000 is the cap on it. More than that, then I have to pay tax on that. So if my $100,000 home I sell for $350,000, tax free. If I sell for $400,000, well, I have to pay tax on that $50,000. Now, has anyone analyzed the economic impact of that? I don't know, is my answer on that. I really don't know. Offhand, I wouldn't expect that it would have that much of an impact in the sense that most people probably did a pretty good job of affecting their, you know, getting away, you know, previously without paying the capital gains tax. So I'm not sure whether this is more or less restrictive. Before, I could have done it with, you know, $400,000 and get a, you know, $600,000 home. Today I can't do it with $400,000, but I don't have to buy a home. So what's the net effect of that? Probably not too much. I have to say, one of my not terribly proud claims to fame, I think I'm the only person who both paid capital gains tax on a house they sold and did not find a way to write off a loss on a house that they sold at a loss. I think I'm the only person in the country that can claim that.
Well, this is the
Oh, good point. David's point is that this is getting into the nitty gritty of the house, the index that you know I was showing you. Back up. Okay, that house price index only covers homes that are sold with mortgages that can be put into the secondary mortgage market, which the cap on that today is about $330. Okay, so, you know, insofar as these capital gain conditions would have affected house prices, it's probably on more expensive homes than even what we're looking at here, which is could actually be an important point about this index, because it leads me to believe that, if anything, this probably is understating the run-up in house prices, because, you know, in the areas where you have very large bubbles, Boston, San Francisco, the median house price is over $400,000. And what that means is, if you assume an 80 or 90% mortgage, the median house is not even in this index. Okay, that's over the top. And the conventional wisdom, we don't have good data on this, but most of the realtors will tell you that the biggest increases in house prices have been at the top end of the market. So if anything, this might understate the run-up in house prices that we've seen over the last
year. Just why don't we bother to look at it? Of course they're understating.
Well, it's the question is, why are we looking at this if you know, we're missing these houses? It's the best index we have, and for most areas of the country, that does capture most houses, but it misses when you have these really big run-ups in San Francisco, Boston, and New York. Even in D.C., it misses much of the market. I mean, if we had a better index, obviously we would want to use it, but this is what we have.
Yes. Can you talk about what happens when a housing bubble bursts?
Yeah, so the question is, what does it look like when a house bubble bursts? You know, so you have people live in a house and it's suddenly worth much less than, you know, what they paid for it. So what goes on, you know, for those households and those economies? We have some places where we could look to. There were collapses of house prices. I wouldn't say it's necessarily a bubble. What went on in the early 80s, there was a big run-up in house prices in Texas and Colorado associated with the oil boom during that period. And oil prices plummeted. If you go back to 83, you know, they've gone through the roof in, you know, 80, 79, 80. And then suddenly in 82, 83, they just plummeted. The price of oil fell, you know, 60, 70%. And suddenly what had been very valuable land, because there's a booming oil economy, it suddenly became almost worthless. And a lot of people saw their houses, you know, just collapse in value. There were a lot of bankruptcies, you know, a lot of, you know, forced sales, people taking huge beatings on their home. So, you know, that was the story there. There were also big collapses in house prices in the Boston area in the early 90s, also in Los Angeles in the early 90s, associated with the downturn in the defense sector. So, you know, those were, you had a lot of people go bankrupt, lose their homes in bad circumstances. We don't have a really good model for, you know, sort of a large scale nationwide, and again, I should use that cautiously, a situation where you have bubbles collapsing in lots of different parts of the country at the same time. And I'm a little hesitant to, you know, generalize too much from those past bubbles to the current one, or last period of house collapse, price collapses, the current one, in part because this is likely to be more broad, but also I think people in general are much more heavily extended. So you have, you know, you've had a lot of banks. You know, we have sort of exotic mortgage instruments where, you know, people were sometimes able to buy homes putting almost nothing down. That wasn't true before. They get zero principal mortgage interest on mortgages. So in a lot of ways, I think people are much more exposed in their housing than they were in those prior periods, which actually leads me to believe it might be more serious. Can you comment on that?
Yeah, because the other part of the scenario that you're hearing is because a large part of consumption in the last few years.
Yeah, so the point is that with, you know, the housing market has been driving the economy. I mean, I sort of, the analogy I've often used is that basically Greenspan got us out of the stock bubble by promoting the housing bubble. So I said it's like the alcoholic who gets over one hangover by starting on the next. And, you know, what's happened is, in addition to a huge boom in housing construction, housing itself is about 60% of the economy, we've also had this huge boom in consumption. People are, you know, buying cars, they're taking vacations, they're refinancing, they're taking money out of their house. That's been spurring the economy the last 4 years in a very big way. So when house prices fall off, that goes into reverse. You have all these people who thought they had a 400,000 home, today they have a 300,000 home. They suddenly realize they have to start saving in a really serious way for their retirement. So consumption falls off hugely. That gives us a very serious downturn. So that's why, you know, what may happen in the case where you have sort of a localized collapse of house prices like we did with Texas and Colorado in the 80s, or in Boston and Los Angeles and a few other places in the early 90s, might be much less severe than what we might see, you know, with an unraveling of the housing bubble. So, you know, that's what I'm saying. I think we might be looking at a very, very big hit to the economy that might be very, very hard to recover from. Good question. It's not a pretty model. Yeah, no, the question is, what sort of hit did Japan take with the collapse of their housing bubble in, well, the late 80s? Japan had a housing bubble coinciding with the stock bubble. It was probably a more serious housing bubble than what we had here. I mean, there's stories that I was reading, I don't know them to be true, where supposedly the land underneath the Emperor's Palace was worth more than the whole state of California. Now, that's something I don't know. I didn't try to study that, so that might have been something someone just made up. But, you know, but it was almost certainly a much more serious bubble than what we had here. But what happened? Well, they had basically, 15 years of stagnation. Their economy is now growing at a pretty good pace, and it has for about the last year and a half, 2 years. But for the longest time, they had a recession in 1991, very weak recovery, another recession. They had about four recessions where their economy is actually shrinking in this period from 90 till 2003. And in the periods where it wasn't shrinking, for the most part, it was growing very, very slowly. So they had about 13 years of extremely slow growth, or actually decline in their economy. Now, part of this was they had really bad policy, so I'd like to think that we could do better. But the point is that, you know, you can end up in a very, very bad situation. It's not easy to recover from, you know, from the collapse of a financial bubble. And, you know, that's a good example of what could happen. So the question is, are there other countries that, you know, are going through housing bubbles and might face a downturn in their housing market? And the answer is yes. There's several other countries. It seems to follow mostly the English speaking. There's actually a reason why that might be true. I won't play the English language. But England has a housing bubble. New Zealand, Australia, possibly Ireland. It's a little harder to tell. Some of the countries in continental Europe might have one as well. But I think it has more of an impact in the English-speaking countries, primarily because of our financial system. It's easier for us to borrow against our home. Okay, in Germany, you can borrow against your home, but it's much more difficult. We have it, it's very, very easy. You know, land is made up, so it's, you call over to your bank, they're down in a few minutes, and it's very easy to borrow money against your home. So it has a more direct effect on consumption. But to give you an idea of how it can have an impact, I don't know of anywhere where house prices have actually begun to decline, possibly in England. Takes a while to tell with the data, so it's a long lag, and it's hard to get good data. But at the very least, in England, house prices have leveled off. Okay, so they're still rising, they're rising at a very slow rate. They were projecting, if you go back a year ago, they were projecting 3 to 3.5% economic growth for the year 2005. They're now looking at growth of about 1.5%. And that's based on house prices leveling off.
Is that just a violent dip in noise, or?
Well, my guess, the question is, you know, can we expect, that there'll be just a leveling off as opposed to a bottom dip? My guess is that we will end up with a sharp dip. The exact timing is going to be very hard to tell. My guess is England will also end up with a sharp dip. But what I take as being instructive is that simply a leveling off, so that people have less opportunity to borrow against their home than they did previously. You know, they have been rising, now it's just level. So you thought you're going to have another 10% of equity in your home, turns out you don't. That's already created huge hardships in England. Their unemployment rate is rising. Their, you know, retail sales are stagnant. Their economy is barely growing. Bankruptcies are at record levels. There's a lot of big impacts just associated with prices leveling off. But I don't think that's the end of the story there. Now, again, I don't know as much about England's housing market as I do here. My guess is that their prices will probably fall. But the big difference that I could identify between here and England, and I'll be cautious here because, again, I don't know that much about their market, is we have huge building and housing. I think that's less the case in England simply because they have more restrictions and are pointing to the fundamentals. I might be able to say, well, there is actually a constraint on land there. I don't know that to be true, but I'm more willing to believe that. I know that is not true here because we're building over 2 million units a year. So if there's a constraint on land, by comparison, in the 80s into the 90s, we're building 1.4 million. Okay, so we're building about 40% more units every year than we did in the 80s and 90s. So clearly that constraint on land is not binding in the United States. In maybe more so in England. So there might be a different story of how the house prices move there. But again, I think the one lesson we can take is that just the level of law had a very large impact on their economy. Completely unexpected, too. I mean, it's one of these things that's kind of mind-boggling to me, but you know, their finance minister, Gordon Brown, is sort of, oh my God, how could this happen? Who could have thought, you know, it's still much. And that was a surprise.
Yes.
Sort of okay, the first question is, the biggest run-up in home ownership, increase in home ownership rates, has been for people under age 25. And then the second point was that residential investment this year, GDP is at a record. The first point, I actually didn't know that. It's very interesting.
Look at that, the HUD, kind of, I think it's market characteristic.
Yeah, no, I am familiar with the data.
Yeah, you
what are the current numbers?
Excuse me?
What are the current numbers and how many people? I don't think there's that many people who own houses under 25, so if you just get a few that are buying, then you can
yeah.
Yeah, well, the
percentage.
Yeah, no, this percentage point changed. So the point is that there's relatively few people who are homeowners under 25, so it may not be all that surprising that you have the biggest percentage point increase. My guess, though, is that you probably have a lot of, you know, young people whose parents are helping them buy homes. I was on a panel once with David Lirov, the chief economist of the National Realtors Association, and he started saying, no, there's no bubble. You have lots of people with affordability because, you know, their parents are giving them help with the down payments. Well, wait a second here. Let's imagine this were a stock market we're talking about. So we have people, we have internet stocks that have gone through the roof, and they're borrowing from those internet stocks to buy more internet stocks, and we go, there's not a bubble. That wouldn't be an argument I'd want to make. But that may well be what's going on. Again, I hadn't realized there was a big increase among that age group. But, you know, we know, let's put it this way. We know that pay is not going through the roof for people under age 25, so it's not that people under age 25 are a lot richer than they used to be.
You have to wonder about their judgment in terms of speculating.
Yeah. We also know that they have a lot of college debt. Heather Boucher does the analysis of their college debt, and, you know, we know that's through the roof. So we have a lot of people, they're not more well paid than they were 10, 15, 20 years ago. They have a lot more debt, and now they're buying a home. So, yeah, I mean, I think that's what you'd expect in a speculative run-up. Now, the other point, residential investments are contributing to GDP, that's exactly right, and that's, again, what you would expect with the housing bubble. So right now, if you know you can build a home and sell it real quick, you'll make a lot of money. You know, if you build it today and aren't able to sell it for a year or two, it might be a different story. But, again, that's a market response. You know, so when you have a run-up in house prices, the response is we have a lot more supply, and we're seeing that. You know, which is, again, why I say that it's not a fundamental. If we really were suffering from a basic constraint of land, we wouldn't be seeing, you know, over 2 million homes being built. We should be seeing 2 million homes being built, but we can only build 1.4 million because, you know, as Dan and Brian Michaels won't let us. So obviously, you know, those restrictions are actually viable.
Let's see. You didn't ask a question yet.
In terms of housing bubble trends, you mentioned England, New Zealand, Australia, English.
That's asked me a tough question.
So the question was, Canada's English speaking for the most part. We could blame the French speakers. Do they have a housing bubble? As best I could tell, you know, don't follow their data that closely. I mostly know this from, you know, reading the IMF's mother places that have done international comparison. But my recollection was Canada does not have any unusual run-up in house prices. So it's a good question as to why that is the case. And I don't know enough about the state of their economy to answer that. So that's a good question. Again, I'm pretty sure that there's been nothing unusual, not to say that there might not be some inflation in, you know, Vancouver or something, I don't really know. But I don't think they have the sort of nationwide story, or at least large chunks of the nation that you certainly have in New Zealand, England, U.S., and Australia.
The other instances where there is this
okay, so the question is, in these other countries, do they have very low interest rates, and have they eased their requirements for getting mortgages, as has been the case in the U.S.? The answer is that they have had low interest rates in all these places, and they have eased their requirements, and I don't know in great detail all, because one of the things you find is that, you know, the finance of housing is kind of a mess, I mean, in the sense that, you know, it's very country-specific, and there's some commonalities, and they are probably getting more, you know, moving together, converging, but there's still very big differences. And one difference that I know in the case of England as compared to the U.S. is the overwhelming majority of mortgages in England are adjustable rates, whereas in the U.S. it's still a minority. You know, it's around 30 or 35% are adjustable rates. So what that means means is they move up and down with their short-term interest rate, whereas ours, it's far more, the long-term interest rate is far more important. So that's a different story in the U.S. I believe in Australia and New Zealand, they do tend also to be adjustable rate, but I have to say they're not that familiar with the mortgage markets. I can't say that for sure. But worldwide, we have had a period of very low interest rates, so that has led, that has helped to propel this, you know, run up in mortgage prices or house prices in a lot of these countries.
Yeah, I just
so the question is, can the increase in house prices be explained by the increase in home ownership? I have a hard time buying that for a couple reasons. First off, the increase in home ownership actually hasn't been that much. You know, so we've had some increase in home ownership, and people make a big deal about that, but we've actually had an increase in home ownership most of the time. That's kind of the norm. So what we had was a period where home ownership did not increase in the 80s, you know, basically because of a weak economy. That's pretty much the norm. So it had not been associated with the run-up in house prices previously.
And the other point,
yeah, no, that's a very good question. So the point is that, you know, maybe it's the case that financial managers are actually held too accountable because they have to meet quarterly targets and they're measured against their peer groups, and it's easier to tell the story with the stock market that, you know, if you're managing a fund in the late 90s and you weren't heavily into stock and, you know, everyone else was, people said, what are you doing? You know, you're just getting, you know, the bond interest rate, whereas these folks, the stock market's going up 15%, you know, we're losing all this money. It's a very good point, and there is an accountability there, but it's a very peculiar sort that you could, if you're wrong the same way as everyone else, you're okay. So in this case, you know, you do exactly what everyone else does, you're fine. Then when the bubble bursts, well, who could have known, you know, I did exactly what everyone else did. I think, you know, your point's well taken. The point is we have to change the incentive. So that, you know, being wrong the same way as everyone else, if all you're doing is what everyone else is doing, why don't we just get some high school kid, you know, pay them the minimum wage and they could do it after school, you know, it's, if that's all you're doing, you know, so there has to be some deeper responsibility. And fine, you just did what everyone else did, but you just lost us 30% of our money, so, you know, you're out. So I realize that might put people in a tough bind because, you know, when everyone else is making all the money, then you have to explain why you're not. But, you know, it can't be an acceptable answer. I just did what everyone else did. Okay, last question is, when will the bubble burst? And I've been saying it will burst for 3 years now.
Which bubble?
Housing bubble. The stock bubble, I was saying that for 3 years, too. So I have a record on this. No, the timing is very, very hard. Now, what's been going on with the Fed is quite interesting, because, you know, Alan Greenspan began raising the short-term rate in June of 2004, so it's now almost a year and a half that he's been raising the short-term rate. Just recently, we started to see long-term rates rise. You know, so we could have gone back, I think it was as of September, the long-term rate was actually still below the level it was at the point where he started raising the short-term rate. And he's been sitting there kind of mystified. He's referred to this as this conundrum, he can't figure it out. My explanation is that you have foreign central banks, Chinese and Japanese central banks that, you know, are acting in the U.S. market, because, you know, basically the markets, you know, if you think for a moment, I mean, Alan Greenspan could come and give my talk and say, well, interest rates are going up, you're an idiot if you have money in long-term bonds right now because you're getting, he almost did do that, by the way, but he didn't quite come out and say that. You know, he would do that if you're doing, you know, if I were running the Fed, that's what Alan Greenspan is doing right now. But, you know, he's acting and they're raising the short-term rate. What's going on is the Japanese and Chinese central banks don't want the housing bubble. They want to keep long-term rates down because we're their export market. So they're trying to keep the dollar up. They're trying to keep long-term rates down. They're buying long-term bonds. So Greenspan, on the one hand, is acting on the short-term rate. They're acting directly on the long-term rate, and they've been keeping long-term rates down. So even as Greenspan raises the short-term rate, they're offsetting that. Now, how long they keep doing that, I don't really know. At the end of the day, it ends up costing them a lot of money. You know, at the moment, so, you know, just for the moment, they've decided it's more important to maintain this market for their exports. Whether they'll continue to do that, or I guess I should say, how long they'll continue to do that, that's the question that I don't have any answer to. Okay, I guess we have one more question. Do you still have a question? Yeah, okay, that one's easier question to answer first.
The question, why does this data start in 1953?
We pieced together a couple of different series. I think you want me to go into great detail about the series, but one of the series that we use, the furthest one back we can get goes to 1953. So they're probably, my guess is actually the Bureau of Labor Statistics has that series further back, but it's not available on their website. We called them up, they gave us the hard copy of the 53. So my guess is that if we went down there and rifled through some old drawers, we could probably find it. It's the sort of thing that next to no one knows about this. Because I've been on some panels with other accounts, I go, where did you get that data?
I knew about this for some other reasons, but
my guess is that they actually do have it back prior to 53, but this is the best we've been able to get our hands on.
So that's an easy one.
And is it weighted by region, or is it capital weighted?
In principle, it would be capital weighted.
Value weighted. So a home that's $400,000, the price increase of that would come twice as much as the price increase of a home that's $30,000. Whether that's always done perfectly or not, I think I have some questions about. But in principle, that's what should be the case. The other point: where does the stock market sit today relative to its peak in
2000?
Well, the stock market, if you adjust for inflation, has fallen back to roughly a third. So you had a price-earnings ratio of over 30 to 1. Today it's about 22, 23 to 1, somewhere around there. It's actually it might even be a little less than that because profits have really gone through the roof in the last year or so. I would say that the market is still not quite high compared to its historic value. So anyone who thinks that they would get, I was saying before how the historic return had been 7%, anyone who thinks they can get 7% at least for a long term stock market would be badly mistaken. My guess and whatever stock market prediction is that it's worth, I think it actually will fall because my guess is that the story we're looking at is the housing bubble collapses somewhere in the not too distant future. It may have already started to. I was making a joke about this that I was, looking at future prices for lumber and for paperboard and other construction material and transit employment and everything. And that led me to believe that we're starting to see unraveling of the housing bubble, along with the fact that the Sunday Post real estate section, all the listings said big price reduction. So you didn't see that 6 months ago. So I do believe we're starting to see the unraveling of the housing bubble now. Definitely a different psychology. And when the housing bubble starts to unravel, well, the economy goes with it. It's a record share of the economy. It's about 6% of the economy. If we look to prior collapses of the housing, we haven't had a housing bubble like this, but we have had housing-like downturns in the early 80s and the 70s. The housing market can easily fall off 40 or 50%. That you've seen that other times, so that wouldn't be unprecedented. That's on the order of 2.5 to 3 percentage points of GDP. That's a really big deal. On top of that, consumption falls with it. Because people are borrowing against their homes, that stops. You lose value in the home, you can't borrow against it. You're looking at a very serious downturn. No one in the stock market is pressing that in. Okay, so that's that's my stock market forecast. Somewhere in the not very distant future, the housing bubble collapses.